If you've noticed the sermon outline on the back of the bulletin, you would know that the portion of God's Word we're looking at this morning is not Isaiah, but rather Ephesians. So I'll ask you to turn with me to the book of Ephesians in chapter 1 for starters. This is a sermon, as you've heard already, on the topic of love in the church. It's a sequel to last week's sermon on love in the home, and it's an interruption to our ongoing series of studies on the book of Isaiah. And I explained last week, as we looked at love in the home, that there were four reasons why we were making this particular interruption. So let me explain to you again, and here are four more reasons why we're looking at love today, love in the church. Here it is. First of all, we're looking at Isaiah, and Isaiah has so very much to say about the sovereignty of God that it's good for us every once in a while to step out of that and to hold on to something that you absolutely must keep hold of while you're considering the sovereignty of God, and that is the responsibility that God gives to all of us. You've got to keep these two things straight, and whenever you're delving into one, delve into the other. God is, after all, sovereign. He is entirely in control of all things. We need to know that. So much depends upon us knowing that, but we begin to make mistakes if we're holding on to that. We forget what seems to contradict that, but is still is true biblically nonetheless, the fact that we are altogether responsible for our actions. Great harm comes from forgetting that God is in control while understanding that we're responsible for our actions. Great harm comes from forgetting that we're responsible for our actions while holding on to the fact that God is entirely in control. So we need to do both, and that's why we're going to look at one particular responsibility this morning, the responsibility we have to love one another. Now, the second reason why we're looking at love in the church is that the book of Isaiah is not without some practical application. It's just that the practical application that Isaiah confronts us with has more to do with point one, the lives we live, and point three, the work we share, than it does point two, the love we show. So we'll take a little break from an emphasis on character and an emphasis on our mission, and look at the middle thing, an emphasis on our relationships. And that's the second reason we're looking at love in the church. The third reason fits alongside the third reason from last week. We looked at love in the home last week because it was the Sunday after Valentine's Day, and some of you were still celebrating Valentine's Day, and some of you were recovering from Valentine's Day, and some of you were still ignoring the fact that it had been Valentine's Day. And so we wanted to look at love in the home, love between married people, love between all those who live in a home together. Similarly, today we look at love in the church because tonight is the evening of the annual meeting, and it doesn't hurt at all for us to remember that we are obligated to love one another before we do the tricky bit of business called a church annual meeting. And those of you who are new to us and checking us out, you want to come tonight and see how we do at loving one another. Well, we'll set our edges here. We'll get our focus by looking at love as we're called to it in the church. And the fourth reason I said last week that we're looking at love in the home was a surprise. Well, the surprise had to do with this week. Last week was a setup for this week. And it's hard to do a surprise twice. Some of you are here in the earlier service and you know what the surprise is, but some of you aren't, so you still don't know. Let me just say there's a special surprise ending to the sermon this morning, and all will come clear. So don't get up and walk out halfway through. You'll be haunted for the rest of your life, not knowing what the surprise turned out to be. So stick around. Let's look together at the book of Ephesians and the idea of love ruling in the church. And we start with Ephesians chapter 1, verses 4 and 5. Paul the Apostle says this, He chose us in Him, that is, God the Father chose us in Jesus Christ, God the Son. He chose us in Him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and blameless before Him. In love, He predestined us to adoption as sons through Jesus Christ to Himself, according to the kind intention of His will. Here's one of the tricky places in the New Testament where the difficult concept of predestination is plainly mentioned. We lay this alongside what we see in chapter 2, and another tricky doctrine or concept, although it's not considered to be as tricky, it actually is when you work it out. Chapter 2, verse 1 says, you are dead in your trespasses and sins, and then verses 4 and 5 say, but God, being rich in mercy, because of His great love with which He loved us, even when we were dead in our transgressions, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved. And here's the equally tricky idea of regeneration, though you need to look into it a little further than you have to look at predestination before you know that you're in deep waters. Now, what you want to notice about the idea of predestination in chapter 1 is it has to do with the love of God. In love, He predestined us. And this is of great interest to me because I know some people who absolutely detest the concept of predestination. Now, I can understand people detesting the concept of predestination if they detest God, because it is a God concept. But what's strange to me, and in fact ironic, are the people who love God and hate the concept of predestination, because we wouldn't have the concept of predestination except it was handed to us by the apostles, by Luke in the book of Acts, and by the apostle Paul in Romans and 1 Corinthians and Ephesians. The word predestination shows up in our culture, in our vocabulary, in our language. This is a plain historical fact. There would be nobody saying anything about predestination except for the apostle Paul and Luke. It comes to our civilization from the New Testament. It's there in the New Testament. And the irony is that some of the people who love God and hate the idea of predestination do so because they sense that if the idea of predestination catches on, it would greatly slight the idea of the love of God. That if predestination were true, then God would not be a God of love. That's what people think. And the irony, if you're looking for it, the irony is that Paul only uses the word predestination here to explain the concept of God's love. In love, he predestined us to adoption as sons. And similarly, the concept of regeneration is introduced in chapter 2 in order for us to understand the love of God. Chapter 2, verse 4, because of his great love with which he loved us, he made us alive, or he regenerated us. So there's an interesting parallel irony to this predestination thing. The other reason that the people who love God have for hating the concept of predestination is that they're afraid that if it catches on, people will stop trying, they'll stop exerting their efforts, they'll stop caring, they'll say, well, if it's true, then it doesn't matter what we do, does it? So they're afraid it'll breed a sort of fatalism or a sort of complacency. And the irony there is that it's mentioned in chapter 8 of Romans expressly for the purpose of encouraging us in our perseverance. The concept of predestination is explained in Romans chapter 8 so that we will persevere. And if you can't see how that fits, then obviously you need to study Romans even more closely. It's there for that reason. So it is ironic that they're all over the world and all over this community, certainly there are people who love God but hate predestination because it makes God unloving. Not true. Or because it makes people complacent. Not true. It's in the Bible to show us the love of God. It's in the Bible to show us that we can persevere. And enough of that. If you're having difficulty with the concept of predestination or the concept of regeneration or any other biblical concept, let's take a note here. This is point number one. When love rules in a church, there is a supernatural knowledge of God's love and the love of Christ for us. That's the first statement today. When love rules in a church, there's a supernatural knowledge of God's love and the love of Christ for us. Now, why do I say that the knowledge of God's love and the love and the knowledge of the love of Christ is supernatural? Because of chapter 3, verses 14 to 19, where Paul prays, or at least reports, to the Ephesians that he's praying for the Ephesians for a miracle. See how he calls upon God to do a special supernatural work. In chapter 3, he says in verse 14, I bow my knees before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name, that he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with power through his Spirit in the inner man, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. Now that's the miracle he's praying for, that they would be so strengthened in their inner being, that so empowered by the Holy Spirit that Christ would dwell in their hearts by faith. Now get this straight. He's not praying for a group of non-Christians here. He's not praying that they would invite Jesus into their hearts, which is the modern phrase for becoming a Christian. He's praying for Christians here. He's praying for people in whom the Spirit of Christ dwells. For if the Spirit of Christ does not dwell in you, you do not belong to him, we read in another place. He's praying for Christians, and he's praying for this miracle, that they would be so strengthened in their inner being that Christ would dwell deep down in their hearts by faith. He's talking about a deeper intimacy, a deeper dwelling of Christ in the hearts of Christian people than they're presently experiencing. And why is he praying for this particular miracle? Why is he praying that they would be strengthened so that Christ would dwell down in their hearts by faith? Well, here's why. Verse 17, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, and to know the love of Christ, which surpasses knowledge, so that you may be filled up to all the fullness of God. You see this? That you'll never understand, you'll never know the love of Christ, you'll never grasp the dimensions of the love of Christ, because the love of Christ surpasses knowledge unless God does a supernatural work in you. So Paul is praying that God would do the supernatural work in them, that he would strengthen their inner beings, that Christ would dwell so fully in their hearts that they would come to know the dimensions and know the love of Christ in a personal way, and then they would be filled up to all the fullness of God. Whether we're filled up to the fullness of God in part depends upon whether we understand the love of Christ for us. It's foundational. It's the rooting and the grounding we read here in chapter 3. And so you see that the concept of predestination, which has to do with God's eternal love for people who are not eternal, his love outside of time for people who are living in time, his eternal love for those who are experiencing love in time and space, it's a concept that you cannot understand without God's help. You'll never get the height, the depth, the width, the love. You'll never know the love of Christ if God does not supernaturally empower you to do so. And if he does, then you're rooted and grounded in love. You've got the foundation laid upon which a loving life can be lived. So that's our first truth. There's a supernatural love of God's love and the love of Christ for us. So here's something we should be praying for ourselves. Here's something we should be praying for one another. When someone in the church family comes to your mind, you can safely say to the Lord in prayer, "And Lord, he doesn't know how much you love him." And that's, I mean, nobody does, right? It surpasses knowledge. It's infinite. So it's safe to say this, even if the person's advanced in his knowledge of love, there's still lots of room to go. So, Lord, she does not know. He does not know how much you love him. So strengthen his inner being so that Christ could dwell deep down in his or her heart through faith, so that he or she in a new way will come to know how much he's loved, knowing the love of Christ. And then, more than ever before, he will be filled up to all the fullness of God. That's something we should be praying for ourselves. That's why the prayer is here in Ephesians chapter 3. It's a prayer we should always be praying as we look to the Lord to enable us to live the life that he's called us to live. And the life that he's called us to live is a life of love, as we will see by moving on. So let's move on to chapter 4, which is the very beginning of the practical section of Ephesians. And it starts out this way, chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. "I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, entreat you, beg you, to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you've been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, showing forbearance to one another in love, being diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace." So take a second note. When love rules in a church, point 2, there is humility. I'll give you a moment to write these down. There is humility, gentleness, and patience. There's humility, gentleness, and patience. And that lines up with what we saw last week from 1 Corinthians. Where there is love, there's patience and kindness and humility, we said. This week, where there's love, there's humility, gentleness, and patience. And so there is the unity of the Spirit. There is the unity of the Spirit. We saw last week that if people like a married couple and their kids, or any other group of people, are going to live happily, lovingly, under the same roof, God needs to be at work, because it's not at all natural for people, being what people are, to live happily and harmoniously under the same roof. They need the patience, the kindness, the humility that comes from the love of God being poured out into our hearts. And just as it is unnatural, but potentially supernatural, for people to love one another in a home, so it's unnatural for people to love one another in a church, but it could happen if God would be so kind as to pour out into us an understanding of his love, and then would empower us with the patience, the gentleness, and the humility of the Spirit, so that we would be diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit. In actual fact, though, it's no more natural for people in a church to love one another than it is for people in a home. Now, it's different. Trying to love the people in a church is different from the challenges involved in trying to love people in a home, for a lot of reasons. This will mean something too if you're here last week. For one thing, churches don't have front hall closets. So the tidy people who start off every family experience in a bad mood because of what the messy people have done in the front hall closet don't have that same challenge in a church. In fact, you know, not only do we not have a front hall closet, but under the coat racks we got bricks, so that if people of the messy persuasion kick their shoes off, it doesn't even make a black mark on the wall. So, you know, we're immune from some of the irritations that are part of home life. But we're not immune from irritation, because in actual fact, scrape off the veneer, we who hang around a church are just as irritating by nature as all of us who hang around a home irritating one another. People are, by definition, by nature, by temperament, by inborn crabbiness, irritating. And the more time you spend in a church, the more you see that that's true here as well as it is at home. Now, complicated by the fact that people come to church with different expectations. And in some cases, if you come from a more or less godless home, a home where God is more or less ignored, then you come to church, you have high expectations. Here's where my religious friends are. Here's where the spiritual people are. So that when they at the church turn out to be pretty irritating, it's crushing. And it can be even, you know, harder to bear than the irritation that you're used to at home. So the need we have at home is parallel to the need we have in the church, to be patient and gentle and humble towards one another, to preserve the unity of the Spirit, to get along well with people who are, by temperament, like we all are, kind of irritating and either messy or tidy and driving the messy people crazy, or grumpy or happy, or driving the grumpy people crazy, or loud or quiet or whatever. There's an offensive element to all of us, and we need to guard ourselves against offense by demonstrating humility and gentleness and patience. And by that means, we will guard the unity of the Spirit. And this is central to our very reason for being. We mean to display the greatness of God by our relationships to one another, by the love that we show towards one another. And if people are getting to know us and they get below the surface and, you know, get beyond the hi, how are you in the church foyer on a Sunday morning to real life and find that we're a bunch of miserable old cusses who are deeply offended at one another and inclined to talk about each other behind one another's back because we found so-and-so so irritating, it does not demonstrate the greatness of God, except perhaps the greatness of his forgiveness to put up with a bunch of unloving people. But we mean to do better than that. We mean to love one another with such a supernatural love that the love we show towards one another demonstrates that we are disciples of Christ, and that Christ is of God, and God is a great God. And that's what we mean to do. And we should mean to do it, because here it is in God's Word. So let's look at chapter 5 and take another truth. This is the verse that was read for us already, chapter 5. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and walk in love, just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. So point 3 would be, when love rules in a church, there is a deliberate, continual, church-wide intention to love people as Christ loves us. A deliberate, continual, church-wide intention to love people as Christ loves us. We say church-wide because this commandment is not to some individual Ephesian. It's to the Ephesians. It's to the whole church. So the obligation is church-wide. We say continual because Paul says walk in love. And walk here is a metaphor, a figure of speech for living. Why is walking a metaphor for living? Because your life is the sum total of all of your days, and every individual day is the sum total of all the actions you took that day, all the steps you took. So life is like a journey. And did you have a good journey or not? Well, it depends on every single step and what they add up to. So did you have a good life or not? Depends on how you lived every individual day, which in its own way depends upon how you took every individual step. So life is a walk. It's a journey. And we are to walk in love. That is, we are to continually be loving one another. And we say deliberate because Paul the Apostle says we are to walk in love by imitating God. And the imitation is conscious and deliberate, like a child deliberately imitates his parent. You know this from your own reflections of your childhood. You remember doing things just the way your parents did it because that's the way they did it. You may remember, recall it from experiences as a parent. And you see that your kids use the very same language when they bump their heads against the doorpost as you use when you bump your head against the doorpost. And that could be an alarming thing. The children deliberately imitate their parents. So God is our Father in heaven. We are to deliberately imitate him, and his love is sacrificial. We're to imitate Christ, who you could say is our Father as well, the everlasting Father, or you could say is our elder brother. Both metaphors work, and we are to imitate him as he laid down his life, as he sacrificially offered himself up to God. That's the sort of love that we are to deliberately and continually imitate on a church-wide basis. And this fits alongside what we saw last week in the obligation we have at home to love one another with a Christ-like love. Husbands are to love their wives as Christ loved the church. That means to love them sacrificially, to be willing to die for them. We talked last week about how, in actual fact, very few husbands have the opportunity to, you know, jump in front of the speeding train to push their wives out of the way. Very few people get the opportunity to literally lay down their lives for someone, but that's what we're called upon to do. So meanwhile, while we're waiting for the opportunity to be dying heroes to our loved ones, we have many tiny opportunities to lay down little bits of our lives, and that's what we're called upon to do as well. And similarly, in a church, there aren't that many opportunities to die a hero. There are in some parts of the world where the church is persecuted, but there aren't very many opportunities in North America to die a hero, to take the bullet for someone in the church. It could happen, and our obligation is to do it. Our obligation is to die for one another. It should be just a rule of thumb. With the love of Christ dwelling in our hearts, we should be able to say to one another, "And I would die for you because you're my brother or you're my sister." That's just how it goes. But you don't usually get the opportunity. I told you last week a fictitious story about a couple of couples shopping at an outlet to illustrate the story of possibly dying for one another. Let me tell you a real life story that I was involved in about the idea of dying in a church. Before I came here, I was an assistant pastor at a big church in Toronto. And that's early 80s. These are special days. The senior pastor of the church was a marvelous guy in the prime of his ministry, named Arnold Reimer. Known to his friend as Arnie, and he was the senior pastor of the church. Older than he and working in the church was a man who did the seniors ministry, and he was sort of like the grandfather figure. Arnie was like the father figure. And then there were three young men. I was one of them. Like my three sons. He was Fred McMurray, and we were the three guys that worked for him. I did college and career and discipleship. Another guy did music, and another guy did senior high youth. And we were Arnie's boys. And big church, we used to parade out in our blue three-piece suits every morning. It was a very majestic thing, and at least it felt that way. And we would sit behind the pulpit, in front of the choir, but behind the pulpit, and Arnie would preach, and we stayed there through the morning service, and looking over his shoulder at the people he was preaching at, sort of cheering them on. We loved him. He was our man. He was our boss. He was our hero, and we adored him. And one morning, early in the sermon, actually one service, just as the sermon was getting going, something kind of unusual happened. Two men in Italian suits showed up at the door of the sanctuary and stood there. You can see the silhouette. They stood there, and this was the 80s. They were dressed in a striking way. These slick, dark suits. As Debbie remembers the story, they had violin cases, but I don't think they did. That's not true, but they looked like they should have violin cases, if you know what I mean. They stood there in the door, sort of casing out the joint, and then, I was watching all of this and having a hard time concentrating on the sermon because of it, one of them very deliberately walked down the aisle and took a seat. They don't have pews there, they have seats, like theater seats. So he took the seat right on the aisle and just stood there with his eyes glued to the senior pastor. And then the other guy, very suspiciously, started to excuse himself as he made his way through the last row of seats, which is right up against the back wall of the sanctuary, and took the middle seat. So there he was, I was thinking Wyatt Earp, there he was back to the wall, and his eyes were glued on the senior pastor as well. And I knew what was going on. I mean, I've seen a few movies. I knew what was going on. So I look over at at my buddy, the youth pastor, and he's a rough and ready guy. He was part-time youth pastor. He was a firefighter. He'd already won a medal for saving some little girl's life, jumped into a thing of water and pulled her out from drowning. It was a great thing. He's a hero. This is my chance to be a hero, too. I look at him. He looks at me, and I mean, it was just so cool. We just nod. Because we know what's going to happen next, right? Any minute now. I don't know what he preached on that day. It's completely gone from my mind. We had other things to think about. Any minute now, these two guys in the suits are going to jump up. They're going to pull out guns. And I knew what I was going to do. He knew the nod meant, yeah, we're both in. We're going to leap up, throw ourselves a human shield, throw ourselves on the senior pastor, put him down on the floor. Like this is a Secret Service at its best, right? And save his life. Unfortunately, the whole front section of the choir would be gunned down. But you can replace a choir, right? You can't replace a senior pastor that easily. So we were ready. It was a special moment. Now you wonder what happened next. Well, isn't life funny? Almost nothing happened next. The sermon just went on, point one, point two, point three. And then it ended. Then there was the closing hymn. Then there was a benediction. And we all got up and walked home. that's really kind of disappointing. We're all set to lay down our lives. We were in young 20s, thick hair, and we were full of spit and vinegar. We were ready to do what you have to do to look after your guy. And that's what you should do, right? And that's what we should all be willing to do. But you hardly ever get an opportunity to do that. You certainly don't get two opportunities to do that if you do it right. So what do we do in the meantime? Well, in the meantime, we look for all the little ways to lay down our lives for the brethren, to love one another with that Christ-like sacrificial love. So while you're waiting for the guys with the guns to show up, what do? You make a meal. You take it to a sick person. We have this roster system so that when someone's sick, or actually when a baby's born, the family gets served meals. You can get on that roster and do that. But it's even more exciting to just go ahead and make a meal for someone who's not on the roster just because you know there's a need. Or you fill in for a Sunday school teacher. We've got a substitution system. But maybe you just do that anyway. You just tell somebody, I bet you'd like a week off, middle of the year. Why don't you just take a couple weeks from now off, and I'll fill in for you. Or you become a children's church worker. There's a little advertisement for that in the bulletin. It's been there a while. Now, people aren't, we're all so humble. No one's jumping at that. But you could sign on and become a children's church worker. Or just, cleaning up a mess that you see in the church kitchen or down a hallway. This is the way, in tiny increments, to lay down your life for the brethren. And you'll have opportunities to do that, whether or not you ever get opportunities to be a hero. And that's what God is calling us to do. I want to say to you who are getting to know the church, just new here, so snooping around, getting to know us, you'll see a lot of examples of that. One of the reasons I count it such a privilege to be a part of West London Alliance Church is just there's a whole lot of that going on, a whole lot of sacrificial cleaning up after each other, a whole lot of laying down their lives for one another. It's going on. And we know to give God the glory for it. It's God's love poured out in our hearts, showing up in the little acts of kindness that are part of church life here. But it needs to be a part of church life because it's what God calls us to do. So that's something we should pray about as well. And now let's go on to point four. And we get that from Ephesians chapter 4, verses 11 to 16. Let me give you the blank first, and then we'll look at the details in Ephesians chapter 4. When love rules in a church, point four, there are godly elders and pastors who equip, unite, mature, and build up the people of the church. That's a lot of words. There are godly elders and pastors who equip, unite, mature, and build up the people of the church. Now, it's a point altogether too technical, and it's actually a little speculative to bother with, but it would be my opinion that in verse 11, when Paul the Apostle talks about pastors and teachers, he's referring to a group of people that we would know as elders and pastors. I think I could prove that, but never mind. You can take my word for it if you like. I think when he talks about God giving pastors and teachers of the church, pastors means shepherds. He's meaning what we mean by elders and pastors. And it's the elders and the pastors who are to equip the church people for the work of the ministry. So that's the direct work of elders and pastors in verse 12, to equip the saints or the people of God for the work of service. But of course, if pastor or elder means shepherd, then there's lots more, needs to be lots more shepherds in the church than just those who are on the board of elders at any particular time. And of course there are. Care group leaders are shepherds. Cell group leaders are shepherds. Youth group leaders are shepherds. Children's ministry workers are shepherds. And all the shepherds and the teachers, the pastors, the teachers, are to work together to equip the saints to do the work of the ministry. That's their direct work. And the indirect benefit comes in verse 13, where the church is united in faith. We all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God. The people in the children's ministry, that's the children. The people in the youth ministry, that's the youth. The people in the care groups and the cell groups get equipped to unite together in faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God as the people of the church who lead those groups are equipped and equip others to do so. And the result is maturity. It's a metaphor here in verse 13. The result is a mature man. That doesn't mean mature people. That means that the whole church together is like a mature man. Christ is the head. We are the rest of the body. And together, united to Christ and growing up to our proper function as individual parts of the church, we become like one mature man. That's the maturity. And the result is that we build ourselves up. The church builds itself up. That's verse 16. The growth of the body for the building up of itself in love. And what you want to notice there is that love is woven all the way through it. It's the building up of itself in love that verse 16 talks about. And love is mentioned in verse 15 where Paul the Apostle says we are to speak the truth in love. And you know what's really interesting about verse 15? In the actual language that Paul the Apostle uses, the verb speak does not occur. He doesn't actually say speaking the truth in love. What he actually does is he takes the word truth, which some of you will recognize as a noun, and he makes a verb of it. So he actually says truthing it in love. And of course we have to speak the truth if we're going to be truthing it. But he means more than speaking. It's not just what you say. It's who you are. It's what you are. It's how you act. We need to be living out the truth, but in love. Truth in love is the destination that we're traveling towards as a church. And if all goes well, and the pastors and the teachers, the elders and the pastors, the small group leaders and the children's workers and so on, are successful in equipping the saints for the unity and the maturity that we're striving for, the result will be a church that builds itself up in love. And can you picture what that means? Building up itself in love. What it means is that with the love of Christ in your heart, you reach out to people. For example, your neighbors, your relatives, your colleagues, you reach out to them with the love of Christ. You invite them in, whether into a cell group or into a special event or into church services, whatever you think they're up to, as God leads you, you invite them in. And as the faith of Christ takes up a place in their hearts, as they begin to believe, as Christ dwells down in their hearts by faith, they're added to the church. So the church has grown in number. And because they bring strengths and abilities, the church grows in strength and quality. But it's done so in love. We've grown up in love because with love we've reached out to other people. And that's the responsibility of all of us who are in positions of responsibility. It's to build up so as to enable one another to reach out with love. And the result is that the church grows in depth and in size. And so the question comes to us, how do elders and pastors and Sunday school teachers do that? How do they equip? And that brings us to our fifth point and actually brings us to the surprise. So let's switch from Paul to Peter. Go to 1 Peter chapter 5, and there's a very simple answer in the first place to the question of how are church leaders to equip the people to do the work that builds up the church. Chapter 5, verses 1 to 3 of 1 Peter says, point 5, when love rules in a church, these godly elders and pastors are in the first place examples to the flock. These godly elders and pastors and cell group leaders and Sunday school teachers and so on are in the first place examples to the flock. How do you teach the church to love? By being an example. Let me show you that from 1 Peter chapter 5. Verse 1 says, therefore I exhort the elders among you as your fellow elder. Verse 2 says, shepherd the flock of God among you. And verse 3 concludes, proving to be examples to the flock. The elders and people who function as elders are to shepherd the flock primarily by proving to be examples to the flock. That's what leaders are to do. So then let me ask you, let me ask myself, how will I illustrate to you what it looks like to be an example of love to the flock? And here comes our surprise. Let me tell you that this morning is a historic moment in West London Alliance Church history. Wouldn't know that it is, but you do know it's the date of the annual meeting. And because the nominating committee has been successful in securing the names of a couple gentlemen who are willing to serve as elders, if the church will elect them tonight, in addition to a couple of elders who are already in place being re-elected to a position, a couple of other elders, men will be elected to the elders board and will strengthen the board by joining us. But as a couple of men are coming on the elders board, one man is stepping down. And this is not all that unusual. It happens all the time. People take a break. They step down off the board. But it's a historic moment for us as a church family, because the particular elder who's stepping down off the board with the annual meeting tonight has never stepped down off the board before. He was an elder when I came to the church 16 and a half years ago. In fact, Dwayne Murphy has been an elder for 19 successive years. And although he's only stepping down for a break, I think, I'm sure that future nominating committees will be leaning on him to step back up in the future. He's taking a break this year. He's coming down off the elders board, and he's never done that before. And I didn't want that moment to pass, because surely it's a record that will stand, without marking this occasion and addressing the fact that God has been very good to us in giving us the stability and the strength of Dwayne's leadership over my 16 and a half years here, and in fact the last 19 years. Dwayne Murphy was the man who wrote me a letter when I was that assistant pastor in my 20s with all that thick hair back in Toronto, inviting me to bring my wife to London in June of 1984 to candidate for the position of pastor. Dwayne was a fellow standing in the parking lot when Debbie and I drove up on a Friday afternoon in June of 1984 to begin the candidating experience. And he was the guy with the firm handshake who was the first to shake my hand and welcome me with his wife Janice, who back in those days was our full-time volunteer secretary. I'll let you know, it was a scary thing to go visit the leadership couple. He was the chairman of the board and she was the full-time volunteer secretary, and I thought, whatever it is, if I don't like her, it's going to be mighty tricky to negotiate around. But that was never a problem, and to this day, Jan continues to be the full-time secretary, although along the way somewhere we started to pay her for all her hard work. But I digress. We're talking about Dwayne. He was the guy that took me on a tour of the building, showed me the sanctuary and the kitchen, the little tiny kitchen back in those days, and the rest of the building. He's the fellow who, with his wife, drove Debbie and me up to Bill and Liz Russell's house for a barbecue, which was the beginning of our candidating experience at West London Alliance. And he's the guy who stood with Debbie and me in the parking lot on Sunday afternoon when all the rigors of the candidating process were over to pray with us that as the church family made up their minds about what to think of the candidating experience, and as we went home to wait for an invitation or a lack of invitation and to decide what to do about that, that God's will would be known to us and that we would come to London if in fact God was leading us that way. And then besides that, and I can think of 1,000 times over 16 and a half years, Dwayne has been the man who stood beside me and who's offered me his counsel and his encouragement and his strength. He's the guy who almost every year has sat Debbie and me down in my office before we took off for our summer vacation just to pray for us. I never thought to ask him to do that. He just kept volunteering to pray that God would give us a good summer holiday. He's the guy that I've had breakfast with at Harvey's until Harvey's went broke down there on Oxford Street for years talking about church life. And he's given me his encouragement. He's given me his instruction. He's given me his criticisms. He's criticized me in the most loving and helpful way when he thought I was quite out of line or doing something that was questionable. He's the guy who lovingly asked the question and got me back on course. And I'm so glad to know that in the years to come, Lord willing, though for at least this next year he'll not be a member of the elders board meeting in my family room on alternate Wednesday nights, he'll still be there to offer me support and encouragement. And I thank God for Dwayne Murphy. I want to mark this occasion, and so at this time I'll call upon a member of a past elders board, that's Ralph Postma, and a member of the present elders board, that's Steve McDonald, to come forward, and they have a couple of words to say about Dwayne. And as they do, I'll ask Dwayne and Jan to come and sit in the front pew with me, and I'll help Dwayne to cope with his discomfort as we make a little bit of a fuss this morning.
Good morning. I'm Ralph Postman. I consider it a privilege to be doing this at this time. My family and I first came to West London Alliance in the fall of 1986, and we still get warm fuzzies remembering those first few months here. We were from a background where when the service was over, people would nudge and elbow each other to get out of the pews and up the aisle and out the back door. And suddenly here we were, part of a church where people sat down after the benediction and began to discuss and debate and fellowship with one another. I well remember the delight of being part of that. And no small part of that delight was the man who sincerely and warmly greeted us at the door, and after the service was over, came and sat in front of us, put his elbow over the back of the pew and said, "So how are you folks doing?" The question came from a heart that really cared and took the time and interest for a real response. That was the beginning of our relationship with Dwayne, and in the intervening years I've grown in my love and respect for him. His life has been an example to me, a model of godliness and Christ-likeness, faithful, genuine, gracious, humble, loyal, unpretentious, man of principle, man of prayer. Over the years, I've been privileged to serve on the board with many good and godly men. Dwayne is likely the one I most readily relate to. I can remember times on the board when someone would say something I just couldn't figure out what he meant. And I didn't want to ask because I thought everybody else understood. Well, it was usually at this point that Dwayne would interject and say, "I hear what you're saying, brother, but I don't know what you mean. Could you explain that for me?" And then it would be made clear for the benefit of a guy like me who would have gone on in blissful ignorance because he was too proud to ask. I always appreciated that about Dwayne. And now, after many years of faithful service, I understand that Dwayne's about to step off the board for a while. And I say, good for you. Well done. I know you'll continue to serve in other capacities, and I'm confident God will continue to make you a blessing, just as you have been to us who served with you on the board. Dwayne, I personally think it's been a long time coming, and well deserved. May God richly bless you in your hiatus.
Good morning as well. Good afternoon. Paul in 1 Corinthians encourages us by the words, "Whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God." And I think we can say with all sincerity that Dwayne Murphy does exemplify that. Dwayne has served our church in multiple ways over many years, and we've heard already, I'm just going to relate the story about how he was part of the elders' board that first brought Pastor Wilkins and his family here, but you've heard about that already, and that's 16, 17 years ago. For many of you, I'm sure Dwayne was one of the first friendly faces that greeted you when you walked through the doors, and it was for me. I remember meeting him that first week, shaking hands with him, and then in the ensuing weeks, he'd come up and greet me with, "You know, how's it going this morning, Doc?" He remembered. He didn't just meet, but he remembered who you were. God has blessed our church, Westland Wise, in so many ways with so many good people. And it's amazing to see what God can do in the lives of individuals as he works. And I think Dwayne, again, has exemplified that. 1 Timothy outlines the qualifications of an elder, and some of which are to be above reproach, the husband of one wife, temperate, self-controlled, hospitable, respectable, able to teach, gentle, and a good reputation with outsiders. And to the younger man on the board, Dwayne is an example of these. One example of having a good reputation with outsiders comes through a mutual acquaintance of both of ours. It's a neighbor of Dwayne's and a patient of mine. And this fellow is quite a character. And in his own words, which I can't repeat exactly here, he really does say that Dwayne is a man of good character. And I think that's really, it's not just in these walls, but it's outside that Dwayne is modeling that. This morning we're thanking Dwayne publicly for all his years of service to our board. But we also thank God for, and praise God for enabling and strengthening Dwayne to serve over these years.
Dwayne, you know that we've been together so long, and I owe you so much that mere words would fail, no matter how long I went on, expressing my gratitude to you and my thanks for all the help you've been to me personally and all the good you've done for this church. You know my theology. You know that ultimately I thank God for what I see and what I've experienced from you. And my theology is confirmed by Jan, who lets me know that the godliness that we've all benefited from wasn't always a character of your life, but it's God in you since the days that God got a hold of you and brought you to himself. I know that you do this for God, not for us. So you look to God for rewards, not to us, and so you should. But I would like to parrot the words of the Lord that you serve and say to you with all sincerity here at the end of 19 years of successive leadership, well done, you good and faithful elder. You have served the Lord, and you are entitled to great reward hereafter and in the days ahead of us as a church. I'm so glad that your support and encouragement and your question of me is not coming to a conclusion. I can look forward to continued opportunities to benefit from your wisdom and your support And I do thank God for you and for your wonderful wife, Janice, and for all that you've done for us as a church. I want to give the worship team an opportunity to come up here and get in place for the conclusion of the service. So we'll just take a little bit of a break while they scamper up to where they're going. And you can't really duplicate a surprise, so you'll just have to bear with us and pretend that Dwayne is shocked by what happens next. But what's about to happen next is a simulation of what happened at the conclusion of the 9:15 service. I just want to conclude by saying that while we look forward to a continued association with you here in the church, and me personally, I'll be looking to you for counsel and so on, we'll be thinking of you this year. And as we're meeting on Wednesday nights, doing the work of the elders board, and you won't be with us because you don't have to be, we worry that you'll be bored or run out of things to do. So we put some money together, and we sent your son Dave shopping.